Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you ever wondered what makes the folks in Great Britain so polite, it's, I think it's the fact that they have to talk, it's the necessity of talking about the weather almost nonstop. Because the weather in the United Kingdom would make a sane man swear. And so it's just a regimen of restraint that is learned at an early age by undergoing the submission to weather, which, you know, you hear that cliche, four seasons in one day. Try four seasons in 1 hour. None of them good. Anyway, before anything else, so.
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
Ladies and gentlemen, my, well, let's call it my fixation on the use of the word so at the beginning of answers to questions. Kind of sounds smart. Has caught fire with at least some listeners, so they're tipping me off to all the various iterations of this annoying habit. And today's example comes from far afield from radio or television interviews. It's a videographer slash interviewer who's, I think, probably being paid to attend and interview a gentleman at a booth of a technology manufacturer at a trade show. And they each both begin their sentences with so.
So we're here at the ARM booth. So who are you?
Hi, I'm John Hyland, Vice President of Marketing for the Physical IP Division of ARM.
So what does that mean? What do you do?
So physical IP is all about chip implementation.
So what are you showing over here?
So we're talking today at the show about manufacturing leadership.
So getting down there to 14 nanometers is kind of like a huge thing, right?
Well, so actually 14 nanometers would be a kind of a tiny thing, but otherwise you're right. So hello, welcome to the show.
Can't help feeling those good old days don't seem so far away.
from London, England, home of really strange weather. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, news from outside the bubble. Well, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I'm sure you heard the news about Rupert Murdoch's impending divorce from Wendy Deng. Here's an interesting angle on it from the British newspaper The Telegraph. Tony Blair is the godfather of one of the couple's daughters, Rupert and Wendy's daughters. He now faces the delicate diplomatic task of deciding whether to support the 82-year-old tycoon or his 44-year-old wife. Blair was reportedly present in 2010 when the girls, the two daughters, were baptized on the banks of the Jordan. He was said to have attended the ceremony garbed in white. That'll remove the stain, Tony. Wendy Deng moved to the United States after growing up in China. She was befriended by an American woman who taught her English and offered to sponsor her studies here in the States. After having taken up the offer and moved in with the family, she embarked upon an affair with the woman's husband. He duly divorced his wife and married Wendy. The marriage lasted 4 months, during which time she gained a green card. All really you need to know, don't you think? Anyway, a spokesman for Blair tells The Telegraph, quote, "We are not making any comment on the matter." This comes up because one of the people most avid in calling for the United States and Great Britain to help the Syrian rebels, aside from John McCain, is Tony Blair. According to The Guardian, Britain should arm the Syrian rebels and consider opposing a no-fly zone over Syria to prevent, quote, catastrophic consequences, according to Tony Blair. He said the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government and the involvement of Iran in the civil war meant intervention was necessary. Blair said the conflict was no longer a civil war. "We should be taking a more interventionist line," he said. "You've got to create the circumstances in which Assad is not able to change the balance of power within the struggle by the use of outside forces." He suggested regime change in Syria was inevitable. "It's exactly," he says, "the arguments we went through over Iraq." Unquote. Tony Blair, thanks for the warning, Tone. Tony Blair, ladies and gentlemen, makes his money these days advising dictators in countries like Kazakhstan. But he gains his gravitas from being some sort of roving peace ambassador in the Middle East. And you don't really need a roving peace ambassador in the Middle East unless the place is at war. News from outside the bubble. Did I say that was a copyrighted feature of this broadcast? I mean it. Of course, don't worry about Wendy Deng. She will have a nice settlement, although not the rich settlement that Rupert's second wife, Anna, got, because this time he got a prenup.
I can assure you that the board will give full consideration to everything you've just said.
Well, thanks, Rupert. I just don't want... Well, I do want to add to your embarrassment, actually.
Yeah, I think we can stand that embarrassment.
Okay, good deal. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet.
Addy, our friend the Adam, you have a good vacation?
Yeah, great one.
You feel refreshed and everything?
Yeah, got all my quarks in a row.
All right, then. A simulated nuclear accident in Scotland, in Ayrshire, saw unacceptable delays in emergency response times, according to an official report.
Bad dress rehearsal, good show.
Exercise Senator was conducted in September 2011 by the British Ministry of Defense. The exercise simulated an accident involving a truck carrying nuclear warheads on a highway in the hypothetical scenario, which involved 1,000 personnel or more from 21 separate agencies, the warheads catch fire and begin leaking radioactive material into the air.
Could never happen. It's totally hypothetical.
Mm-hmm. Designed to test multi-agency response times and reactions, the official report found a number of shortcomings. The report from the Ministry of Defense notes that it took 5.5 hours for a specialist team to arrive at the scene of the accident, described as realistic but not adequate.
Reality is never adequate.
Hmm. The lack of support created, quote, major difficulties for the multi-agency response, which struggled to attain a meaningful understanding of the issues, according to the report.
I struggle with that every day.
Scientific and technical advice provided by the Ministry of Defense to local agencies was also deemed not adequate, with no apparent leadership or structure, and repeated changes in representatives from the staff responsible for providing technical information, who at times disputed advice provided by local agencies. Meanwhile, agencies at the accident site responsible for treating casualties, quote, became disorganized, and it was, quote, less than clear who was in charge of medical arrangements at the scene.
Maybe they need more rehearsal.
There was, quote, considerable delay in developing a plan to manage casualties contaminated with radioactivity and, quote, significant further delay in sending paramedics into the contaminated area to help casualties. As a result of the delays, exercise controllers said that a seriously injured casualty who might otherwise have survived had died.
Well, he didn't really. It's just simulated.
Simulated death, that's right. The report also noted that personnel tasked with briefing the media about the incident were misdirected to the wrong location, and it was not until day two of the exercise that a press conference was held. What?
I'm not a big fan of press conferences. I've never had one.
Nuclear plant operators will have to pay compensation of up to $1 billion Canadian to those affected by an accident under soon-to-be-introduced legislation, says the Canadian Federal Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver. A critic of the proposal says that still amounts to a subsidy for nuclear power, since the actual damages will probably range far above that.
Those are Canadian dollars anyway.
They're worth more than ours now. Yes. The private company that manages nuclear waste tanks at Hanford in Washington spent millions in taxpayer funds over a period of a year, despite evidence the work would never be used. Documents obtained by the Seattle television station King 5 so the federal government's prime contractor, Washington River Protection Solutions. We got too many solutions in search of a problem these days, ladies and gentlemen. That contractor spent as much as $14.2 million on work to prepare a tank to serve as the primary feed for Hanford's waste treatment plant. That was chosen to be the first tank to gather and mix waste from dozens of other tanks at the huge nuclear reservation that would be piped to the waste treatment plant to be converted into stable glass logs.
Just imagine Christmas time sitting watching a nice glass log.
Yes, I can. The treatment plant is under construction but riddled with design and technical problems. It's uncertain when the plant will be finished or operational. Until that happens, the 28 double shell tanks at the site, including the one selected as the prime feed tank, are expected to keep the radioactive and chemically contaminated nuclear waste safely stored underground. But starting in about a year and a half ago, leak detection instruments showed that for the first time at Hanford, one of those double shell tanks was breaking down and leaking. Nuclear waste was leaking into the tanks annulus.
I have mine checked every year.
That's a good thing. The contractor did not do a thorough inspection to confirm the leak. Instead, the company pressed on with the original plan of preparing the tank as an important waste feeder, using millions in government funds to continue preparation work. Work the company earned bonus awards on. We knew we should change direction after the instrumentation showed the tank was leaking, said an instrument technician for the project. The man who first discovered the leak, Mike Jeffrey, there was no way it would ever be used as a feed tank, but instead we wasted a year of designing when we could have been using that time and money to investigate using another tank. The leak, which was confirmed to the public only last year, rendered much of that work useless. The type of mixing work that the tank would be used for, were it put into operation, could potentially make the leak worse, which could lead to spilling large volumes of radioactive waste into the annulus, where it would be exposed to the outer wall and eventually the surrounding soil. That tank already contains some of the most dangerous radioactive elements. The sludge and liquid in it contain radioactive isotopes of plutonium, americium, strontium, and cesium.
Those are my four faves.
The 865,000 gallons of waste in that tank is considered the most hazardous of all at Hanford, in part because of the extremely high heat load sitting at the bottom of the tank due to the amount of strontium-90 in it.
That is the very best strontium money can buy. 90. They don't mess around with the 89.
The leak in a massive underground tank at Hanford has grown significantly worse since it was first announced, according to sources who have seen new inspection video and photographs. The sources who spoke with that same television channel said the amount of waste that is spilled out of the tank has grown substantially in recent months. Nothing from you.
I don't know. I have no leaks.
Dateline Brussels, nuclear power plants in the European Union should be tested every 6 years for safety shortfalls. That was according to a proposal this week in a bid to draw lessons from the Fuk meltdown. Quote, the fact remains there are 132 nuclear reactors in Europe today, said EU Energy Commissioner Günther Oettinger. Quote, our task is to make sure that safety is given the utmost priority in every single one of them, unquote. So checking them every 6 years would be the utmost priority. Tokyo Electric Power Company has issued another correction for groundwater radiation at the Fuk No. 1 nuclear complex, now says it's only a tenth of what it announced earlier this month. This was the second time the beleaguered utility has changed its estimate of contamination in the groundwater. It's desperately seeking fishermen's consent to divert or dump the least tainted portions of the water into the Pacific Ocean to prevent it from mixing with highly radioactive water accumulating in the reactor buildings. When it runs out of storage space, the tainted water will flood the premises and the environment, making the decommissioning process incredibly difficult. The latest correction could deal another blow to TEPCO's efforts to dump the water by further damaging its already low credibility. The radioactive water accumulating at the plant is a natural result of the makeshift cooling apparatus set up to keep the fuel from melting again.
There's no shift like makeshift.
It is my favorite form of post-nuclear accident response. Makeshift. More about the results of, or the after effects of the Fukushima accident. Researchers from the Institute for Environmental Science and Technology and the Department of Physics at the Autonomous University of Barcelona have studied the spread of radioactive strontium.
There's that strontium.
In the coastal waters of eastern Japan during the 3 months following the Fuk accident. The samples analyzed show the impact of the direct release of radioactive materials into the Pacific, indicating that the amount of strontium-90 discharged into the sea during those 3 months was between 90 and 900 terabecquerels, raising levels in the water by up to two orders of magnitude. What?
Yeah. It's the best strontium.
I know, money can buy. Keeping the meltdown-stricken Fuk plant in northeastern Japan in stable condition requires a cast of thousands. Increasingly, the plant's operator is struggling to find enough workers, a trend that many expect to worsen and hamper progress in the decades-long effort to safely decommission it. TEPCO is finding it can barely meet the headcount of workers required to keep the three broken reactors cool while fighting power outages and leaks, say current and former nuclear plant workers and others familiar with the situation. Construction jobs are already plentiful in the area due to the necessity of rebuilding after the tsunami. Other public works spending planned by the government under its stimulus program is likely to make well-paying construction jobs more abundant, and less risky, better-paid decontamination projects in the region are another draw. Some Fuk veterans are already quitting as their cumulative radiation exposure approaches levels risky to health, say two longtime Fuk workers who spoke to the Associated Press, requesting anonymity because they're speaking to the media is a breach of their employer's policy, and they say being publicly identified will get them fired.
Well, they're already irradiated, but...
No, don't be that way. TEPCO spokesman Ryo Shimizu denied any shortage of workers, saying the decommissioning is progressing fine.
That's a good spokesman.
That is. The government and TEPCO say they may be able to start removing the melted fuel inside the crippled nuclear reactors around 18 months earlier than initially planned.
That's good news.
Although the action would still be years away.
That's bad news.
The process would... Thank you. The process would reportedly begin with the removal of fuel assemblies from the outside reactor spent fuel pools at units 1 to 4, the latter of which was widely reported to have been exposed to the atmosphere when the building housing the reactor was blown up in a hydrogen explosion. That sounds like good stuff.
Let's makeshift.
According to a revised plan to decommission 4 reactors at the 6-reactor complex, the extremely challenging task of removing melted fuel from reactors 1, 2, and 3, which suffered the core meltdowns, and from the exposed fuel pool of Unit 4, could start within the first half of fiscal 2020 if the efficiency of preparation work is improved. But the government and TEPCO still believe it will take 30 to 40 years to complete the decommissioning process.
I got that much time on me.
TEPCO said this week it has transferred all 24,000 tons of highly radioactive water from leaky underground tanks to surface tanks at Fuuk. The utility moved highly radioactive water to steel surface tanks after leaks were found in the underground tanks in early April. The cause of the leaks remains unknown.
Ever had a leaky roof?
Yes, I have. It's hard to figure out where leaks come from. You're right. Xcel Energy's Monticello, Minnesota nuclear power plant on the bank of the Mississippi River has been unprepared for worst-case flooding for a long time, federal regulators said this week in a finding they say has substantial safety significance. Inspectors said Xcel's flood-fighting efforts, including dikes, could not have been completed in the 12 days required. Some work would have taken twice that time. The finding is the Monticello plant's most serious safety shortcoming. This problem was ranked yellow, one level short of red, or most serious. Three other U.S. nuclear plants belonging to other utilities also have been cited recently for unsatisfactory flood fighting plans.
Well, that's bad news for Xcel. They're going to be punished.
Interesting, you'd say that. They face no penalty, even if the substantial safety significance finding is confirmed. It will be put in a category of more closely monitored plants.
Well, there's your accountability.
There is. Over in France, scientists are studying clay geology to see if it can safely house the country's deadliest nuclear waste. France is seeking the safest option for its mounting stockpiles of highly radioactive and long-life nuclear waste. The planned repository, a third of a mile underground, has provoked noisy protests. They can scream all they want, says a socialist lawmaker who has spearheaded the project for almost a quarter century. In the end, Parliament will have the last word. There's your socialist for you. The installation is designed to hold French military and civilian atomic waste, some of which can remain dangerous for more than 100,000 years.
France has been around for that long, hasn't they?
I don't think so. The French project has cost about 1.5 billion euros since 1991. Runs about 100 million euros a year. The amount doesn't include the 400 million euros in subsidies since 2000 for the two administrative districts straddled by the waste site. And, of course, they haven't buried any waste yet.
Give them time.
Oh, they're going to need time. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, in the What the Frack department, radioactive waste unearthed by hydraulic fracturing is becoming a serious problem in Ohio, according to a new report released by the Freshwater Accountability Project Ohio. The report was authored by Marvin Resnikoff, a physicist at the University of Michigan. He points to what he says is a failure to properly dispose of radioactive waste from fracking. Say, what?
You can have radioactive waste from fracking?
Yeah.
I feel better. I feel better than James Brown.
Good. He says these wastes make their way into municipal landfills in Ohio, costing the natural gas industry 1/100th of what the nuclear industry pays to dispose of similar low-level radioactive waste. It's evident, he says, environmental concerns are trumped by the economics beneficial to the fracking industry. He also says the industry simply doesn't want to take responsibility for the radioactive waste it produces.
Who does?
Clean, cheap, safe. Too wasteful to meter, our friend, the atom. Thank you, Addie.
Thank you.
It's summertime, 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 summertime. Well, shut them books and throw away. Say goodbye to those good days. Look alive and change your ways. It's summertime. Well, no more studying history and no more reading geography and no more Dalgy. I'm three because it's with all romance, oh man, this jive has me in a trance because it's summertime. It's time to head straight for the mills. It's time to live and have some thrills. Come along and have a ball, a regular or free-for-all. It's summertime. It's summertime, 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 summertime. It's summertime.
This is Le Show. And ladies and gentlemen, please give so that public radio can have a new voice. NPR, according to an announcement made public a couple of weeks ago, is looking for, quote, a great voice talent with production chops to match to be the voice of NPR's national funding credits. You'll record all of NPR's support for this program comes from announcements in our national programs. Heard by millions of people each week, you'll get to say, this is NPR, each day. This is more than a voice gig, I'm still quoting. We're looking for someone with serious production chops. You should bring a voice that's clear, confident, and welcoming. And be a bit tingly at the thought that your voice will be part of public radio's daily connective tissue all across the country. Bonus points for ability to sound authentic on the radio. We're not looking for the voice of God, unquote. And they're not the only ones.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Up to Here. Up to Here, CPR's weekly look at the day's news. I'm Milton Getzler. For almost 10 years, all of CPR's broadcasts, from All in All to Book Bag, from As a Matter of Fact to Up to Here, have ended with credits identifying those persons and organizations whose generosity makes these programs necessary. Now, CPR is looking for a new voice to read those credit announcements, and the auditions have just begun. CPR's Ira Zipkin wandered down the hall to be a hopefully unsquashed fly on the wall.
We're rolling any time.
Can you cue me, please?
Anytime. On your own cue. I'm reading.
Okay. Support for CPR comes from the Schettlinger Foundation, making dreams come true and turning truth into dreams.
That's fine. Thank you.
I'm sorry. That was Schettlinger, wasn't it?
I don't know. I'm reading.
In Studio 3C of CPR's new headquarters building, a very special set of auditions is taking place. Call it the search for the voice of a network. Or I'll call it that, and you just keep listening.
What we're looking for is both evanescent and palpable.
CPR senior executive producer Ada Schlorman.
A voice that evokes the CPR mission and at the same time is a pain to the enduring miracle of wealth.
Rolling.
Support comes from the Tire Foundation. Without tires, you're going nowhere fast.
A little down, but excellent. Thank you.
My name's Mike Gray. I worked here about 25 years ago when CPR was just starting to gain some fundraising traction. I'd love to work on my head a little bit, and now I think I'd really love to get back into the whole public radio dimension.
Recruitment notices have flooded the internet, and applicants have come here to Studio 3C from as far away as two metro stops down. And what's remarkable, as always at CPR, is the diversity.
Rolling.
Live on CPR is made possible by the Life Insurance Institute. Life is for a living.
Excellent. And tell us your name once again.
I'm Tom Brokaw, Jr.
Wonderful. Thank you.
It's so difficult to put your finger on anything, let alone what we're looking for here. It's some intangible sense of what it means to be proud of not needing the money and at the same time grateful for actually getting it.
CPR's goal is to have all the funding credits across all its programs spoken in one consistent voice. But some CPR hosts weren't thrilled with that decision.
Well, of course I'd gotten used to doing the credits on my programs, including this one.
All in All host Milton Getzler.
So it was hard for me for the first few weeks not to take this move personally, but then I realized it adds to my credibility not to have to mention all those foundations and corporations. And besides, it means I get out of the studio 20 seconds earlier every day, so I think it's going to work out.
And rolling.
Support for CPR comes from pork. So much more than pig meat. That's wonderful. Thank you, honey.
Ada Schlorman hopes to have the process narrowed down to 20 semifinalists sometime during the third fiscal quarter of next year. I'm Ira Zipkin, down the hall in Studio 3C.
Can I stop rolling now?
And for now, you're up to here. Maybe for the last time, let me say we had help today from the Sandler Foundation, making a difference by being different. Join us next time for another deep dive into the weeds on Up to Here. I'm Milton Getzler in Washington. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And this is your Le Show station and your Le Show host, on the Le Show thing. Ladies and gentlemen, now from the annals of accountability, which are incredibly shrinking annals, as you probably have noticed, or annuluses, Dateline United Nations. More people must be held accountable for the 2010 collapse of the Kabul Bank in Afghanistan. And the agency also calls, the United Nations does, for robust action on asset recovery and financial regulation. It's essential to ease foreign donor worries and ensure continued aid. An Afghan court did sentence 20 men in March, including the bank's founder and chief executive, to between 4 and 5 years in jail. Almost $1 billion was stolen from what was then Afghanistan's largest bank. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described those sentences as relatively light and said the convictions must not signal the end of accountability in this scandal. The collapse of the Kabul Bank triggered a financial crisis, civil disorder, and a run on deposits. The government was forced to bail out the bank, that never happens, which was later relaunched as the new Kabul Bank. I guess the reputational damage wasn't enough to make them want to really change the name. And As if a rebuke to Ban Ki-moon comes this. Wells Fargo Bank has reportedly agreed to a $42 million settlement after being accused by the National Fair Housing Alliance of neglecting the maintenance and marketing of foreclosed homes in Black and Latino neighborhoods, leaving them derelict. The settlement follows a year-long investigation by the NFHA that revealed the homes serviced by Wells Fargo in minority communities were allowed to fall into disrepair. Wells Fargo has not admitted any wrongdoing in the case. As part of its settlement, the bank will provide $27 million to nonprofit groups to promote home ownership, which I guess means people taking out mortgages from Wells Fargo. In addition, we'll provide $11.5 million to the Department of Housing and Urban Development to help 25 other cities. The department did not rule on whether Wells Fargo violated any laws. There's your accountability, Mr. Moon. That you can take to the moon. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's catch up on what's been learned so far about the surveillance of you and me by the United States, by our very own government. Because I'm not really sure about you. Sunday's Washington Post expands our knowledge of what the National Security Agency's, the NSA's, scope and scale of surveillance programs is in the years since the Bush administration, when the new nominee to head the FBI, James Comey, threatened to resign because he thought the Bush administration's surveillance programs were illegal. Shortly thereafter, the Bush, President Bush, or whoever was acting in his name, backed down. And then, shortly thereafter, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that secret court, issued a remarkable ruling redefining what business records meant in cases where the FBI had asked for information on the phone calls of a certain target. They ruled that the business records thenceforth would include all databases from the phone company, not just relating to that particular targeted person. And that opened the door to where we are today. Meanwhile,
clap on, clap off, the clapper.
Well, in this case, James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, you know, the DNI, he testified before a Senate committee in March, and one of the few senators disturbed by all this surveillance, thinking it messes with civil liberties or something, asked him this question.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
Of course, in the wake of the revelations of the last couple of weeks, that doesn't appear to be true. Something that James Clapper, the DNI, Director of National Intelligence, admitted this week.
I responded in what I thought was the most truthful or least untruthful manner by saying no.
That he said because the question he was asked did not lend itself easily to a yes or no answer. So he answered no. In a seemingly unrelated development, RT, the cable and online 24-hour news channel owned by the Russian government, announced recently it's hiring Larry King to bring his brand of talk show to the RT channel. And here's a sample. Back here in this wonderful new studio, RT has built me, makes CNN look like Sid's Deli on Rivington Street. Tomorrow on the program, a very important panel with Carl Woodward and Vladimir Putin. Right now, here in our Los Angeles studio, an old friend of every show I've had since the all-night radio thing, the former lead singer of the boy band Smash of the 90s, Boys Are Us, Dewey Gordon. Dewey, welcome to the new show.
Thanks, Mr. King. I gotta say, lucky I didn't know the Russians had studios like this during my boy band days. I might have defected.
Hey, best Borscht in town right downstairs.
Ah, that's the beat thing, right?
Hey, you're all about the beat. So, Dewey,
yeah.
You're looking younger and better than ever. What have you been up to?
Well, Mr. King, I've been away for about 6 months having a life peel.
Huh? What's that?
It's a face peel done by a life coach.
Mm.
And I have to tell you, I just feel not just refreshed, but actually fresh.
That's great. Now, your band reunited a while back. Mm-hmm. How's that going?
Well, some of the guys are in rehab. Mm-hmm. Some are in dehab. So I just thought it's maybe the right time to rekindle my solo ambitions.
Now, you've always brought us preview copies of your solo efforts. Is that why you're here tonight?
Well, of course, I'm here just to touch base with you, Mr. King. But yes, I do have a song I've been in the studio working on with my wicked great producer, DJ Booth. And it's a song we wrote this week after we saw all the hassle the spy guy got for testifying in the Congress.
That's James Clapper?
I guess that's his name.
Mm-hmm.
But people were on his butt for him saying that his testimony was his least untruthful answer, and yet something about that just rang very almost true for me. So this is that song.
All right, we're going to hear it now?
Unless you cut me off.
We wouldn't do that to you.
Yes, sir. It's called Least Untruthful Answer.
All right, the great Dewey Gordon.
You don't have to lie to me. Don't have to tell the truth. All I want to hear is what you're saying. 'Cause when I stop believing, it's like when I lose a tooth. And hoping that it's so is just like praying. So speak with lots of fibers of your being. Fight disbelief, it's another form of cancer. Let me know there aren't that many shadows of a doubt. Please give me your least untruthful answer. Give me your least untruthful answer. What I want to know from you is more than I can know. It's only that my ignorance is showing. So when I ask you questions, don't let it bring you down. It only means I'm staying instead of going. Somewhere near your heart, babe. Tiptoe through the facts just like a dancer. Don't need a stack of Bibles, don't even need to swear on one. Just give me your least untruthful answer. Give me your least untruthful answer. My faith in you, it can't be tarnished. The truth looks better when it's varnished. When it's varnished. another form of cancer. Let me know, there aren't that many shadows of a doubt. Please give me your least untruthful answer. Give me your least untruthful answer.
Dewey Gordon, we got just a couple of seconds, Dewey. You going to be performing anywhere?
Well, sir, if enough people are watching this, you never know.
Thanks, pal. Till tomorrow from RT in Hollywood, good night.
The moon was all aglow, and heaven was in your eyes. The night that you told me those little white lies, the stars all seemed to know that you didn't mean all those sighs. The night that you told me those little white lies, I try, but there's no forgetting when evening appears. I sigh, but there's no regretting in spite of my tears. The devil was in your heart, but heaven was in your eyes. The night that you told me those little white lies, I try, but there's no forgetting when evening appears. I sigh, but there's no regretting in spite of my tears. Who wouldn't believe those lips? Who ever could doubt those eyes? That you told me those little white lies. Those little white, tiny white, little white lies.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersol, Jr. Dateline Rio de Janeiro. For 20 years, Inalva Brito has lived under threat of eviction from her house in the poor community of Vila Autodromo. The Rio government has given several reasons why demolition of housing there is necessary, but a stronger motive lies behind the latest pressures. Multi-million dollar projects for the 2016 Olympic Games. The 66-year-old teacher is one of 170,000 Brazilians who are at risk of losing or who have already lost their homes in forced evictions linked to preparations for the World Cup in 2014 and the Olympics in 2016, according to Reuters, quoting the human rights organization Witness. The one-year countdown to the World Cup kickoff began this past Wednesday. The country is far behind schedule on many projects to host the prestigious games as well as the Olympics. In Rio alone, The government has resettled 19,220 families since 2009, according to the government. A watchdog group says about 40,000 people are going through eviction in Rio, maybe more. We are seeing a series of human rights violations, especially when it comes to the right to housing, says Renato Cosentino, a researcher at the Brazilian human rights group Global Justice. The teacher said since the government first sent bulldozers into Vila Autodroma and residents filed their first civil action against their removal in 1993, there's been no dialogue, no public consultation. Says the human rights spokesman, many evicted communities don't even know the reason for it, nor have they seen a project. Rio's housing office told Reuters, evictions are a part of a citywide drive to provide comfortable and safe urban mobility to its citizens. The city plans to construct a major bus terminal and two new high-capacity fast lanes for the buses on the land to be cleared to connect to Rio's international airport in time for the games. The remaining land will be used during the games for the International Broadcasting Center and the main press center in the Olympics Park. After the games, it will become a public area. Although the teacher, quoted by Reuters, is suspicious, saying there's a project to build condos on her land after the games. According to the human rights spokesman, 75% of the Olympics Park area is supposed to be made available to the private sector for hotels and apartment buildings. The Rio government told Reuters it's offered the residents the option to move to a housing project under construction 1 kilometer from their community. The My House, My Life project is due for completion next year. The teacher says residents have the right to remain and will not agree. This is public land. We have the title of use document. It should be designated for the people who have been here. 20% of the residents have agreed to move. The rest, we'll see. The Olympics. It's a movement in more ways than one. And we all need one. Every day. And now, just quickly, time for a few apologies of the week. Won't you?
We're so sorry.
Australian radio talk show host Howard Settler is pursuing legal action against a radio station owner after he was fired for asking Prime Minister Julia Gillard whether her partner is gay. His live radio interview last Thursday night made international headlines. Management suspended Sattler, who'd worked at Radio 6PR for 28 years, announcing he'd been fired on the air on Friday afternoon. Station manager Martin Boylan said the conduct was disrespectful. He apologized to the Prime Minister and her partner for allowing Sattler to raise such matters. A British tabloid, The Sun, owned by Rupert Murdoch, has been forced by the Church of Scientology to apologize for reporting that UFOs were seen flying over the church's British headquarters. The Sun said it was sorry for the weekend report, quote, flying saucers over British Scientology HQ, explaining, quote, following a letter from lawyers for the church, we apologize to any alien life forms for linking them to Scientologists. Rupert?
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Deadline Pittsburgh. The field where the Pirates play baseball, PNC Park, had announced a security measure Monday that would have required all fans to be searched by metal-detecting wands that was abandoned minutes after the Tuesday night game against the Giants was scheduled to begin. Initially, many fans agreed the wands were an appropriate measure taken in response to the Boston Marathon bombing. But as the line to home plate entrance snaked all the way to the right field gate, expletive-laden murmurs began emerging from the increasingly restless crowd. By about 7:15, hundreds were still waiting in line. Security personnel were instructed to stop wanding. And Pirates president Frank Coonley said, on behalf of the Pirates organization, I apologize to our fans We stopped the wanding procedure. The experience was simply unacceptable. We will ensure this does not happen again. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and the all-news stream of KCRW.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast. I said free through Sideshow Network, iTunes, and KCRW.com. And it would be just like accountability for the banks in Afghanistan if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast, playlist of the music heard here on, and a fabulous store, all waiting for you at HarryShearer.com. By the way, if you're ever wondering, streams, good, solid audio streams from a lot of the radio stations around the country that carry this broadcast are available to you, can be found on a most valuable website called publicradiofan.com. And, in case you haven't wondered, I'm still on Twitter, at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network. So long from London.